If there is one principle that is absolutely foundational, absolutely central to who we are as Unitarian Universalists, it has to be freedom. Freedom is so important to us. If you look at our hymnal, there's a good 30 hymns in the index under freedom or free and responsible search for truth and meaning. That particular principle, the free and responsible search for meaning, is just one place of two in our short passage of seven principles that talks about freedom, the other being the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. It's for years, generations, really, the primary history of Unitarianism in Europe was written by an author who summed up our core principles as freedom, religion, reason, and tolerance. And freedom was one of the words on the banners that hung from our ceiling here in the main hall for many years. You can see them elsewhere on the campus now in a shadow box preserved, but always up there, that word, freedom. And why not? I mean, we did something that we have, is what draws many of us or keeps us here, the opportunity to practice our faith with a free conscience, the importance of being able to seek out what we believe and what we wish to practice and what we want to do, no matter what our theologies, no matter what our politics. That is really important to almost everybody who comes into a UU church. And you see it there too, the connection between our faiths, which grew and were so strengthened, took their modern forms really in the early decades of this country, in the same time and with the same people who were shaping the country itself. So that people like John Adams and John Quincy Adams and Benjamin Rush and Thomas Jefferson all had connections to Unitarianism and Universalism as they were writing or signing or leading this movement put forth in the Declaration of Independence. That struggle to be politically free and to found a country on the principle of freedom is interwoven in their writings with their religious beliefs that were so often Unitarian and Universalist. So it's no surprise that this is so important to us. And yet it's complicated. Practicing freedom is complicated. We see it on the political level that at the very time that people were founding this country on the principles of freedom and writing these grand words and signing them, many of them owned other people. Controlled them utterly, permitted them no freedom whatsoever from birth to death. And if they saw a contradiction in that, they did not see fit to act upon it or enshrine it in these beautiful words. And what with women also having no franchise, the right over property, what these grand words actually did was establish a country that was far from being free, had a minority of people, a minority of adults even, controlling the futures and property of most of the other adults in the country. So freedom is hard. I mean, it's a grand principle, but it's really hard to practice, to really think about what's involved. And how it's difficult to practice here in our spiritual lives, in the emotional and personal growth aspects of our lives. Well, that plays out right here in church, and I'll tell you a little bit about how. But what really encapsulated for me were the words of one of my favorite writers and one of our great writers who died in January, Ursula Le Guin. Great novelist, writer of short stories, poet, essayist, and public conscience oftentimes, especially in her later years. But back in the 70s, she wrote an essay that really delves into this question of what does it mean to practice freedom, to be free and to make use of our freedoms. It's very challenging to all of us and very relevant, I think, to what we're trying to do here in our congregation, do for each other and the world in the congregation. It was called The Stalin in the Soul. And in it, she tells two stories. Stories of two writers. She's a writer. She's primarily addressing writers, although, as you'll see, it's much more universal than that. But she's primarily talking about writers in her particular genre, the genre in which she was most well-known, although not the only genre by a long shot that she spent time in, that of sci-fi and fantasy. So her first story is about a writer she calls Y, letter Y. Y, she says, wrote a great novel. And when he sought to have it published, sought to have others read it widely, because he was living under the repressive government led by Joseph Stalin, what happened to him instead was that he was punished and persecuted, and finally, in order to have his freedom and escape the consequences of his having spoken out in this novel that was so prophetic, that was so so grand an analysis of his own society, he went into exile. He went into a prison of a kind, unable to be in his native land. And in exile in Western Europe, Y published his book. But all these years later, she says, his book has never been published in his native land, in his native tongue. Then she tells the story of a writer she calls X. X is a math teacher, and he lives somewhere very different. He lives in the United States of America. And he, too, has a great novel. It's in his mind, and he wants to write it. He wants to write. But he's struggling along as a math teacher, and he decides he's going to write first a kind of more popular book, a book that might actually get his foot in the door with publishers in his genre. So he writes this book. She calls it Volga the Visigoth. And this sort of sword and sorcery fantasy book called Volga the Visigoth does get his foot in the door. It's bought, it's published, it sells. And then he finds that the publisher wants him to write more books about Volga the Visigoth. And so he does. And he writes one after another. First, to support himself, to pay the rent, and then to support himself in the manner to which he has become accustomed. And she says, decades later, and then at the end of his life, his great book has never been published in his native land, in his native tongue. He never wrote it. She writes about this, and she's writing about, in the first case, a real author, because she wants the people who are like her, like the second author, who I don't think is anybody in particular, to think about their freedom and how they use it. Y is Yevgeny Zamyatin, and the book that she's writing about is a book called We, which is fairly likened to 1984 as an analysis of political repression, in his case, a science fiction vision of what his society looks like and how human nature responds under repression. And it was so trenchant that indeed the Soviet state said, we cannot publish this. We refuse to let people read this in this country. But you can read it, and certainly encourage you to do that. So he had to go into the prison that is exile and never saw his land or saw his work published in his land. Now all the people like X, as she says, here we are in the United States. We do not have to fear repression. We have freedom of the press. We have freedom of speech. We as writers can use bad language. We can criticize our government. But do we? She proposes that oftentimes we do not, because we have let Stalin into our soul. And Stalin takes a different form. For her imaginary ex, it takes the lure of the market to publish what will be published, what will be promoted, and that desire to sublimate his grand vision, suppress it, instead put out something that will be accepted. And there are other lures as well that Channing speaks about, you know, here the usurpations of society. How much do we conform? How much is it hard to just follow our vision freely, even when there is no one who is going to throw us in jail? Not to pretend that we have the freedoms, as I said, that our country dreamed of, but just the same. We here are among the freest people who have ever been on this planet. Do we use our freedom? A character of hers in her great novel, The Dispossessed, the main character, Shevek, talks about in his society, which is radically free. There is no state, there is no government, there are no laws. There is nothing to tell people what to do except the necessity of their lives and the pressure, the social pressure of their brethren. And he notes how much they censor themselves. He says, we keep our initiative tucked away. We're proud of being so free. But do we use it? And I think that she's challenging us here in this country to consider the same thing. We're so pleased with how free we are. Do we use that freedom? And we Unitarian Universalists who have a free faith that we sing about and read about and speak of all our choices, do we use them? Not that we have to use all our choices. Many of them are unattractive and not what we want to do, but the things that we long for, do we stretch out to the very limits of what we are allowed? Or do we keep ourselves close? Because there are dictators within that say, you have to do this, you mustn't do that. We all have them. Well, that's the job of a writer and a preacher, to help us to notice the way that we are not using our freedoms and to encourage us to use them more. But sometimes the preacher has to learn from the people sitting right here. And I had that experience this week with somebody I was speaking to who gave me permission to use the gist of our conversation. I'm just not going to share her name. And she said to me, this is somebody for whom this congregation is very important. She said, I struggle a lot with depression. She said, and it is hard to belong to a congregation that is so dedicated to social justice. Because she said, although she agrees with the stances and loves the enthusiasm that we have for social justice, she says, you know, there are mornings when it's been 4 days since I got since I took a shower. It's all I could do to get out of bed and get here. That took all the initiative I've got. And to arrive at church and hear about more things that I ought to do, more problems in the world, when I'm just barely holding it together, it's just really hard. It really spoke to my conscience. Although I tell our worship associates and I think for myself all the time, people come here with many, many needs. I'm also aware, well, a lot of people meet those needs. Their inner demons of depression, say, are met by social justice, but that's not true for everybody. And for many people, just taking some action in the community can really help them when they have that inner dictator of depression that lies and rules them with an iron fist and says, you're no good, you can't do anything, getting out of bed won't even help, you're always going to feel like this. That dictator within, it might be pushed back a bit by reaching out. But this is somebody who's already doing that. She knows all that. And she needs something different from her community. I thought, that is another kind of unfreedom we struggle with. Those inner dictators. Depression is one, what might have been called melancholy in another era. And what they might have called fear a few generations ago, we call anxiety. And that, too, is this tin pot tyrant who sits within us and says, everything's falling apart. You have to do something. Nothing you do helps. It's a terrible way to live. It's not free. And we need help out of that prison that is within. That's the language I would love to add here to Channing's. You know, he talks about that, I call that mind free which resists the bond of habit, which does not mechanically copy the past nor live on its old virtues, and that's noble and true. But then some of the freedom that we're struggling for is against the inner voices that say none of these things will work. and you can't, and you mustn't. And what we need may be different in order to be free, in order to live out the freedom that we are given. When nobody is going to throw us in jail, and nobody is going to say, you mustn't believe that or have this religious practice, and yet there is a great, powerful dictator within. It's very true, it too is a prison. That, I think, is maybe what the language of our hymn that the choir also sang so beautifully, that wonderful variation, is getting at when it talks about friends being by shame undefiled. I always have trouble with that word defiled, as if shame is defiling. But I think what the song is saying there is saying that shame too is a kind of prison. That you can be in a physical prison and yet feel no shame, and there's a freedom in that. Well, it's the opposite way too. You can be free. You can live in the United States, a person of privilege in the 21st century, and be just about as free as people have ever gotten, and be in a prison and have a dictator within shouting at you. I'm seeing from the nods that we know what that is. So, with respect to William Ellery Channing and Ursula K. Le Guin, I want to think a little bit about language that might take that in, that kind of Stalin that sits with it. And imagine, I call that mind free that sees its unfreedom and that is able now and then to say, help, I need help. I call that mind free, I call that church free that can reach in to the prison bars and offer a hand, that can offer the light and say, here is another way. Here is more freedom. I call that mind free, I call that soul free that can see that there is more freedom beyond where we are now. So that perhaps a future step, a future movement will be towards that greater freedom, knowing no soul, no mind is completely free. We all struggle always against inner bars or outer bars, against dictators really right there at the head of our government, or the dictators within. And that we can help one another, wherever we are, which with whatever unfreedom we struggle with, we have help here. Let us meet each other with that kind of compassion and help. Blessed be.